really for variation of infections, but is the amount of hormone variation of infections is a cause of action that allows someone to sue a third party who's alleged to have caused the end of a marriage through malicious close contact. And to say the elements of alienation of infections, one must show that there was a marriage and love and affection, and that the defendant maliciously close contact interfered with it, and that it ended in divorce. And this court certified for decision the question whether that cause of action should be abolished in the state of New Mexico, as it has been in at least 38 other states. And in answering that question, with the court's approaches, I'd like to begin with the words of the lower court in this current case. The Court of Appeals in this case said that this court is, quote, an evil relic, close quote, that, quote, diminishes human dignity, close quote, inflicts pain on the innocent, close quote, and that the court would abolish it if it had the power to do so. The Court of Appeals said that nearly 40 years ago, once before, and the district court in this case said so as well. That the courts of this state, with experience litigating day-to-day cases, see no further justice in the existence of this cause of action speaks volumes. That's my opinion. We see many reasons for the abolition of this court, including that it is irreparable, inconsistent results, and unjust jury verdicts. By forcing jurors to consider a question that is explicitly against the public policy of the state of Mexico, of Mexico to inquire into, which is what went wrong with marriage, and that is a quote from Hakala versus Hakala in the Court of Appeals. In that case, the Court of Appeals said it is against the public policy of the state of New Mexico to inquire into what went wrong in marriage. And in this case, the trier of fact, if it is allowed to proceed, will be charged with determining exactly that question. Interpreting that statute and how this does not create enforceable contract obligations, but rather that it states the public policy of the state that marriage is no longer a property of relationship between husband and wife. Exclusive remedy for violation of that statute, and several states have statutes with identical language, is a suit for divorce. The suit for divorce has already taken place. The judgment of divorce was handed by the Boulder District Court, and that is all remedy that statute provides, and indeed it would remain on the books, and would remain a declaration both of the public policy of Mexico, and would be interpreted in divorce cases as necessary. But on its face, it does not create the cause of action against a third party. So it's important to recall that my client, the intervener, is not being sued in this case. She's a Colorado resident, her ex-husband is a Colorado resident, and a Colorado court entered a judgment dissolving their Colorado marriage under Colorado law. And this is a lawsuit between the plaintiff and the defendant, who was not a party to the marriage and did not have rights under that statute.
Damages. Over. Right. And to the spouses of the woman.
questions, respectfully, and satisfactory way, by saying, well, damages are always hard to determine. Right? But in this case, they're going to be able to determine. And I think the Honorable's question is going to that point. I don't really answer that question. I think opposing counsel, Mr. Boyle, may have a different view, but I don't believe in this. The Colorado Supreme Court is currently considering petition for certiorari in the disillusioned marriage case, because it's only exactly that question. How should the court rate the marital estate in filing? And this is a question of whether a third party should be made to pay damages for having supposedly caused the end of marriage. And what the dollar value of that would be, I don't know.
For example, that loss of consortium is fairly ambiguous about something that's not used. Loss of employment of life, that's a rather common
I don't think it has gotten so far in terms of money, although I do think it is something that this court can consider in evaluating the workability of this cause of action. What is, I think, unique about this tort relative to other torts that this court has not abolished is that this court presupposes that individuals' affections or desire to give affection to another person does not belong to her. In a negligence action in which there's loss of consortium claim, the presupposition is that the injured party wanted to give consortium to someone else. Walking through the function and carrying someone else. That is not the presupposition of this court. The presupposition of this court is that defending somehow stole the affections of a grown adult person and makes their own decisions about doing to give her affections. And I think that is a unique difficulty to charge the jury. And I would point this court to the Supreme Court of Iowa's decision in Flutterman, which specifically says that our system of facts, right, I'm roughly quoting here, our system of facts inevitably breaks down. In this kind of case, because the jury is asked not only with quantifying harm from the demise of a marriage, but figuring out why a marriage ended. And that's specifically the charge to the trier of fact. The trier of fact, in order to rule for the plaintiff here, will have to conclude that the plaintiff did not cause the end of the marriage, that the spouse did not cause the end of the marriage, but rather that only the defendant caused the end of the marriage. And to me, that's something that just is wrong.
Used to,
children are harmed in these bystanders of parent-child conflicts. They don't have a voice in this proceeding, and if this case is allowed to proceed, the defendant has an outstanding disclaimer or revenue tax message that you bring their headset about. Excuse me, plaintiff has an outstanding disclaimer or revenue tax message that interviewer has sent about the defendant to anyone.
But again, I want you to address this whole thing. It's not disrespect to the argument, but we deal with this in some cases where the trial court judges have dealt with discovery in personal injury cases, which contained lots of controversial things. And they're very invasive. But no loss of remedy because of that is this true.
It is different because in a loss of consortium case, the plaintiff paying the loss of consortium submits that issue to the trial court. Says, I want compensation for this matter. Intervener had nothing to do with this case. Intervener lives in Ohio. She did nothing relevant in the state of New Mexico. She's alleged to have done nothing relevant in the state of New Mexico. And because of the dispute between the two people, allegedly about her elections, at the law prison that she cannot control her own, she's now subjected to discovery because the case is not being received. And I think that is a relevant distinction between loss of consortium claim, alongside the fact that this does matter of first principles. Loss of consortium claim does not require the court to conclude that human infection is a property right that can be possessed by anyone other than the person's name. So, underlying loss of consortium claim, no one ever says, okay, well, if the manager's having that, then this person might have left her. They say, this person wanted to love me and was harmed in such a way that she could not have been. I think that's sort of the legal distinction. So I'm not arguing it's not that all difficult factual determinations of the jury should depend upon that. You know, nothing that is unquantifiable has to be submitted to the jury. It's no doubt the case that, in the court case, it was raised damages for emotional harm and physical suffering. It's not so difficult to quantify damages issues, but they don't raise any particular concerns. In order to raise, nor do they raise a peculiar problems here, which is the capacity of this court to use for extortion and harassment. Because of the nature of the tort, and this is reflected in the legislative enactments in many other states, where it is including the intervener, plaintiff's home state of Colorado, where it is in crime merely to threaten to bring such an action. The reason that they have abolished that in many other countries is because it is legal in states of this form to send a letter to the court that says, if you don't pay me money, I'm going to file a public document alleging that you committed a violation of the actions. And that will expose all of these violent acts that you intend to keep under the
government. All of them in this court presupposes that the affection is not only by the spouse, whether it's a male spouse or a female spouse. The court presupposes that the third party stole or took away that affection and thereby caused the divorce to occur. So, I mean, how can we say today, as opposed to back in the beginning of time, that a person who's owned their own affection, that they're powerless? How can we say that? Maybe that's a rhetorical question. That's a question that's really bothering me when you're going to this issue. I don't think the damages, I don't think the difficulty, it's the foundation of the form is that you own your own affection.
Our answer is this word constantly. And indeed, I think the reason that the tort supposes that way is because of its historical origins at the time when one spouse owned the other spouse. Opposing counsel wants to this briefing that the tort is now available to plaintiffs and defendants, and against them that is a gender. But I think, nonetheless, the retrograde origin of the tort is reflected in this notion that one person owns another person's affections, whether they're married or not. The allegation in this case is that defendants stole the affection of the intervener from my client, that she couldn't own it. Right? That she's in like a watch. Yes, like a piece of property.
That's right.
And a piece of property that allegedly belonged to her ex-husband, to my daughter. And I think to say that I'm not just disabled is what you're going to do.
Again, returning to the statute, we make 70 an hour here, and we've been working with the statute. The president will let contract go to each other obligation to New Jersey, and Mr. Fidelity, this is what Fidelity is so for. If the legislature, in all their good and bad wisdom, decides to promulgate that statute, can we use that argument? What do we do? Let me ask you straight up. What do we do with the statute? What, in your client's position, is it simply the remedy under 42.1? Is it not a contract claim? What do we do with that? It's such a contract claim. There's, you can interfere with the contract. So we carve out. And interfere with the contract under 42.1. What do we do with that statute?
So, I think what the question is with that statute is, first, is the way that the Supreme Court of Idaho and the University of Idaho interpret that statute is to say it's exclusive remedy if you're lost. That's not saying you can't reach it.
So, if that's still remedy, there's still a claim. And if there's still a claim, there's still discovery. You're in the same boat. Or would discovery be limited to that remedy? Right? I mean, you can say the remedy is support, but there's still a contract.
What's the contract between the plaintiff here and the defendant? There doesn't seem to be a contract between those two. Those are the two that are in conflict with each other. It's not a
thank you, thank you. I'm going to hand over to Chief Justice Gresham just for a moment first and then turn to that question. So, the claim to the extent there was a claim has been adjudicated. Their marriage is dissolved. And in divorce cases in this state and in Colorado, in no fault divorces, recrimination, as it's called, is not a defense to divorce. So, if there's no fault divorce, the court doesn't inquire into that question. But fault based divorces are not on the books. One party could have sued the other party for fault based divorce. Neither party in this case did that. And so that's not to say there's a statute of divorce that has function. It functions in divorce cases. It's also worth noting that this is a Colorado marriage. So no one's alleged to have breached this statute because the statute governs the maximum parties. And it's like right now, nothing to do with the statute of divorce. And I think that our initial position in the Court of Appeals was on Joseph Law grounds. And that is the reason why. So to the extent that it governs, the charter law wants to say that it would allow the state of Mexico to rule over the state of Colorado if not. Because, again, recrimination is not a defense in Colorado. And the parties chose divorce on the grounds of irretrievably broken marriage, as it's called under Colorado law, the fault divorce or irreconcilable differences. And so they think that's our answer to the court change. It's actually not so clear right now. The votes broke out there. That it doesn't apply there with one addition as well. The Court of Appeals in Padua versus Hackney concluded that the defendant, in fact, much more egregious than Zimmer, had not acted without justification. So, to the extent that opposing counsel's analogy to purchase interference with the contract even called at all, the facts are alleged or not, that the defendant acted with the improper purpose. Because, a fortiori, under Padua, what happened here is not a conflict without justification.
If you can't have the remedy of this tort claim continued in the state of New Mexico, technically someone could get their own motions to another person, but not necessarily be unfaithful and to be married in any way. But that would be a cause of action under those circumstances.
If you are asking me to talk, would you like to answer that question? Yes, please. Okay, thank you. So indeed, many cases, the alienation of affection cases do not involve extramarital relationships, but rather, so the case in Idaho was a treating physician had an affair with his own spouse, that's even more unfair, but there was another case involved in sort of male subunions with a different family of things, and I think sort of the much broader scope. Indeed, it's not clear from looking at the older cases in the Supreme Court of Kentucky and Hawaii, the conservative of the states, it's not clear that this is indeed in the wide run of cases. What often happens is, in some respects, even broader, that anyone who might have had some contribution to the end of the marriage, it can be held in court. It can take a while to find the victim. Does it first have a will? That's an organizing question.
Thank you. We'll proceed to counsel for appellees for oral arguments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. The question from the gentleman who addressed early in the morning, I want to start from the proposition that, well, counsel is correct that the United States don't recognize this direct but do. Really, it's important that you, as the Supreme Court of the state, look at what courts have done that are potentially in the legislature to the United States. And the only way you can get to the conclusion that the majority of the states disagree with this court is to take away all of the legislatures. Indeed, there's only really three cases out there that abolish the court. That's exactly right.
So what was the, how does the legislative review help in that respect when that's all we're talking about?
Well, I think part of the argument from the other side is that the majority of states will have this choice. But the vast majority of those, the legislative considerations, the first thing.
But I think in fairness to that longer list of cases is that each of those states, whether it be legislative or judicial, have said that it's violative of public policy. And so there's a through line regardless of more deviating up what the majority of states don't through the line of we think this is part of public policy.
That's completely true. And if you look at those states that judged it based on the courts like this were taking consideration, they find that the public policy supports this more often than that it doesn't. I think that's an important distinction because legislatures deal with other questions. Political expediency and lots of other things that this court doesn't have to deal with. This court has to deal with a great problem. And other judges, sitting in your position, have more often than not determined that this is a viable cause of action. And I think that's just an important distinction so that you don't get into this thinking that we're asking this court to do something that is unheard of, unprecedented. And you
but in order to do that, the court would have to acknowledge in an opinion that a party that a person properly right to a faction.
I believe so. And the reason first of all, we start from the assumption on the other side of this question that what is in
this case, let's start with the assumption of our precedent, which is that, is it not?
I don't believe you have to assume that their rights are property, that their affections are property. Because I think we're assuming that Mr. Butterworth is suing you to somehow right or wrong to his wife's affections. In fact, he's got affections too that have been impacted by this case. His affections, those perhaps they are property rights.
Phil Farmer's affection or his ex-wife, he still has that affection. It has not been, it has not been injured. It's the reciprocal. Well, that has been injured. And that's what you've claimed in this case. You haven't claimed that his affections have been hurt. It's that hers were interfered with as they were indeed being given to the husband.
Yes, but he suffers the same thing. By the destruction of the marriage.
That might be a damage, as I said.
Well, and that's exactly what I was going to talk about. Yes, that ties directly into it.
Where are you, what damages? I mean, I cut to the chase here because that's where I started. Is how are you going to quantify the value, the monetary value of affection? Because that can be taken to great extreme. There is always the unreciprocated price. There's all kinds of affection in the world that may not be reciprocated. Does that have value? Who's going to prove that? What extra witness are you going to call to estimate what the value is? I need to understand what it is your client needs.
The point of this is to recover damages that come to flow from this.
And how is that going to be valued?
And the value is your most damages.
So it would be the same kind of evidence, for example, from the loss of consortium. He's lost the companionship of the company, and why it seems to do when he didn't have loss of consortium. But if I, if they can do that in a jury, can do that in a personal injury case, I would be certain of doing this.
Loss of consortium presupposes that there is a two-way street on the section. But that the spouse who has been killed had affection for the surviving spouse, and the surviving spouse had affection for the deceased or parent and child. That's typically how this works. And in fact, our laws of consortium plan doesn't extend to people who aren't married. But it presupposes a two-way street of affection there, not a one-way street. And you live a one-way street, and that seems to be a problem when you're attempting to base the images based on a loss of consortium. It's a departure.
Part of the proof we have to make is that there was a two-way street before the third party intervened.
Well, I think it, most grown-ups know that if there is an affair that happens, it's typically because the relationship has a road in both formats. So, like somebody makes up one morning and says, I love you, and then 2 minutes later says, and I hate you. I mean, that's just not how a lot of relationships work. So, how are you going to have the damages again to a one-way source of affection?
If one assumes that you can demonstrate that there was a loss of relationship, that there was love and affection, third party comes in and adds to love and affection, I think that is the cause of causality, but it's also the source of the damages. What was the relationship before, and what is it afterwards? After the third party intervener came in and ended the marriage? Yes, I understand. In a lot of cases, there's two sides to the story. There's a two-way street.
But probably 20 sides to the story.
Undoubtedly. And how many kids are there? 10 times future to get to. But the point is that courts and juries sort out that two-way information all the time. That's not an excuse to take away the remedy. That's an excuse to instruct the trial court on how to deal with it.
But your argument becomes a little bit circular, or because all of that presupposes that he has some claim to her affection.
I think it's his affection, his claim, right? I disagree with that fundamental proposition.
The claim is her affection. Perhaps the way I would have asked the justice the question was answered, which is, why are her affections, why is it that his claim isn't based on her affections being his property, right?
I don't believe it is somehow. As the Chief Justice pointed out, the statute says that there is a contractual relationship, and it includes fidelity.
You're not going to a contract that's between the husband and the wife.
Yeah, this is a third-party affair with that contract, just like a contract in the marriage sense. The third party comes and tries to destroy every contractual relationship.
But there's no contract to affection.
There's a contract to fidelity. Is this the right perspective?
Yeah, that's the only thing that we need to address. This claim of affection doesn't necessarily require a divorce. The more powerful of that nature is that it's dealt with in a whole divorce case.
We have a plenty of steps to
go. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
Along those lines, Mr. Wood, your client that his divorce was a no-fault divorce.
Correct.
Now, there was no suit for divorce on the basis of clause.
Correct.
It seems to me that if your client agreed to a no-fault divorce, he is bound by that there was no fault for this divorce, and now he's trying to put an inquiry around that and say that there was fault in that there was an alienation of affection. So that it seems to me that once you agree, no fault, you're bound by it.
I see that you were very offensive.
No.
You said it was a medical divorce, and you
are bound. You are bound by that adjudication. As they are bound by that adjudication. So, what am I missing?
We certainly have a reasonable sort of race to your calendar.
You had a reason. The letter was off.
because they don't come before this court, right? Because the appeal is just moving on. I haven't read any of the records to search and find out how many of these cases have been in your district court across the state.
The district court judge from the other one of the time. So, I mean, I'm using my personal professional experience on that, but this is just not something that has a better option. It doesn't want to tell us something about how to keep this exactly at all. This case.
I don't think it says anything makes me think about this too. I have no idea why a particular kind of rule wouldn't make it like that. I'm a lawyer who takes some clients and I can sure.
You have less than any problems.
One of these? Yeah, I have two. So I don't know about any of that. The other one, I don't know if I it's the kind of claim that is important for the same reason that the interference with contract claim is important on that side. Why would it be that we would protect that commercial contract and not protect the investment damages, etc., in a marriage?
We have to have divorce law to do that.
And that doesn't
so we've supplanted this idea of ownership of affection in marriage and fidelity and all these things. And the legislature has said this. The legislature has said, here's a very specific way in which we are going to heal the demise of marriage. And here are rules related to it, and it's got a definition there. The judge knows exactly how to calculate the damages and how to deal with the children and everything else. There's a whole universe that is set up with groups to actually handle this. This is not it.
Yes.
And I think the legislature has declared very forcefully that that is the path to us in the state of New Mexico.
Yes. I agree with that. But the husband and wife, whether there's a third person involved, or the legislature hasn't spoken, the legislature could have outlawed this
law. That's the new goal. They're having a problem. Common law versus statutory law. I think that Justice Vargas is. That's a important rule.
Yes.
And the legislature has said, we don't care at all about why that works. It's not relevant to the separation of the couple, including what happens with third parties. It's a no. We are not going to tell this that is the path to a separation of marriage.
Indeed, but the legislature has said is that examining the deferral of marriage is not relevant to how property, debt, and spousal support, or child support, or child custody. But they haven't said anything in all of those articles about what about the third party interference. If this was a sound analysis, then the third party interference was contract choice. We have to go away too because the contracts are set up to be between two parties. You know, those two parties have to go and talk to each other about it. Yeah, there it is. What about the third party? Well, it's their fault.
So let me ask you this along the lines of Justice Bacon's question. She's a trial court judge for 10 years now herself. So, what about New Mexicans on the family? Are they under the debate or are they under the impression that now their affections basically are home or someone else's?
I think we know that they're entitled to some sort of mutual commitment of fidelity, for example. It's in the statute.
Maybe people marry and have no obligation to each other for affection. I mean, that's what you have, for example, that wasn't quite out here, but how there we are. Throuples. Three-party relationships where only two of the people can be married to each other. So that doesn't sit well within the society in 2025.
Well, I suppose if the legislature were in there in the to look at the schedule and change it and allow throuples or specific utility or whatever, then you have something to go on there. But that does not happen.
How do you practice fidelity to each other when they get married? I mean, you have all kinds of marriages.
Yeah.
Fidelity isn't, you have open relationships. There's
the facts are the kinds of facts that can damage to the district court. The district realization that the district damages are just some of the ones that
are
there.
The idea that our emotions, our affections, the moment to someone else is on a piece of paper, not several. I mean, that's all it is. And that's most of the things that I want to know. It doesn't have to be a romantic or a romance. It's your affections that want to get you to be. You know, I was there. It sounds like it would be anywhere else. So, you know, I was really surprised by those circumstances.
Well, let's take an example of in-laws. If in-laws destroy a marriage, granted, it happened to be a lie, well, really, we don't have to prove it, but let's suppose I can prove that the in-laws destroy a marriage. Why shouldn't they be liable for the damages of the
family? The only way that you could get that lawsuit is if you prove that the spouse didn't own their own affections, that they were taken away.
I don't think so. I think you could prove that claim if you prove that there was plenty of love and affection, or the something that wasn't. And I think that proves that causation, potentially, by dealing with the prisons. But my point is, if you focus on the traditional notions, even the current notions of marriage and family affections and so forth, then you're doing a disservice to what this story is all about. In the first place, and you're doing a disservice to all of the other tourists out there that would be used to recognize this kind of relational damage.
Is it a disservice to not really drag someone to a divorce court and forget me also? I mean, we are all together in the justice system. It's this overarching idea of people doing two court cases. Even though I know I understand you're not serving the body directly, but it's your family or children.
Do you want to be sure? It is a right reporting until she remains. The wife brought herself into the States.
Her story, her kid's story, her father's story is this case.
And the kids aren't proper witnesses, there's no experts to talk about that kind of thing, so they don't have the kids or customers or any of those kinds of things that happen in the whole space. And then the notion that I've heard the court suggest is about trying to fix her when she put the proof of causation. Experts aren't there for causation. Experts are there for damages and other things about practices and causation, etc. A number of reasons. Causation comes from the facts of what's going on in the ground. What someone did on this day, or what someone did on that day, what happened on this day, and what text message gets sent, and what phone call happened, what email happened, whatever it is. The expert who was going to be able to prove causation. The idea is very simply unsimple. Yes, there are issues involved with this, but if the damaged spouse doesn't have the ability to seek damages against the person causing those damages, then what do we have? The statute has no meaning. It's essentially null. I don't think the court lately disposes of those statutes. And all of the questions we have, and I think every question we discuss is about how do you go about proving this? How do you go, what's fair about this proof? The damages or damages or causation or whatever it is. All of those are legitimate questions, but they're questions that can handle the first case by the district court and by the jury.
So I'll ask you, what are the sources of that question? Bring to court cases most of them have said that the origins of the law are so specious now that even though both men and women can follow this claim, it is no longer supportable in today's society. So, let's talk about the origins of this law. And that goes to the question to be asked about ownership. This is really husbands owned wives.
judiciary.
And that's 6 months in federal.
That's right.
And that's 6 months in federal.
And as I said,
I think the court policy in Utah, frankly, is a little bit different than the court policy in New Mexico and the court policy in Mississippi. Where did it go?
In North Carolina, in Hawaii. In the States, they're different.
But isn't that a problem? Isn't it a problem that other communities get more interested in that on this kind of
really submit that the emergence of this tort are not possible. But I think that means that the tort is better. The world has moved on. It used to be the origin of the law that you talked about. It only a husband could write this. That's how they say it. Only a husband could write the Constitution. Now both courts, and it doesn't require sexual intercourse with the internet. And it's about that. It's about interfering with this relationship that is confirmed by the statute. And if the legislature had thought that statute was wrong, or that statute somehow impacted this court, the legislature has been free for 100 years to undo this tort. But they haven't. And I think that has to be what New Mexicans think about this directly. It says there's a contract, and it says that contract includes fidelity. And after looking at the contract, but there is somehow this ordinance is allowed to really get damages. Maybe you change the name of the structure, effect, and even actually mentions your breach of the statute.
And to what end has that? And then to what end?
There's not a statute out there that talks about intentional interference with contract with the third party and establishes the damages for that. We have no trouble calculating that. There's no statute out there that says that the financial loss of consortium on top of that or
consortium.
But there's no reason to give marriage less protection than the other one.
So you raise a question of how perhaps the things you spoke to that. You have Murray and Burst in the baby 1923, 1925. The Mexico Court of Appeals has addressed this. I understand it's the Court of Appeals. And we're closely bound to our own precedent. So why, under Thompson or Pacino, where did they err in their reasoning? You'd certainly take a position, I think, reading those opinions, and you can tell me if you disagree. If they were the Supreme Court and not Court of Appeals, Birchfield would be overruled.
I think that's true.
Okay. And I've spoken more recently than Birchfield, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So where did the Court of Appeals enter in its reasoning, either Thompson or Hartfield?
I think it did consummate, like it brings in the way to Thompson, I think, ignores all of the arguments about why there needs to be protection to the contracting parties in marriage from a third party interference.
Okay, contracting parties to marriage. I think that's hypothetical. Your clients with the Department of Defense filed this in the past 10 district court and brought a breach of contract. The husband and wife, in this case, brought a breach of contract. Not a divorce procedure, a breach of contract. What would happen to them?
That's when it would be dismissed or turned into a divorce case or something like that.
So how is it that a party in the interference survive?
Well, I think it has to survive because otherwise there's no protection at all.
You can't get a divorce. Just answer my question.
It can't get divorced by third party.
Well, you can't bring a contract claim against your spouse.
That's true.
So how do I interfere with that?
That's exactly my point. If there's an interference, if there's an interference with that relationship, that committed relationship that the statute establishes, then there ought to be a remedy for a breach of that statute.
You're saying specifically what they interfere with. Yes, that's my order. If you think that this marriage is so bad that nobody can interfere with it, then bring that up in the trial court and argue about it.
Because again, it has operation. The opposing counsel said that
if this court rules that we can rule into evidence favor, the statute is meaningless. I just don't get that sort of, you know, they can bring it to our section. That's all. The parties chose
it. What does modality mean that we need in that statute?
It
had in our previous conversation for half an hour. What do we do with the modality?
I think you say it can be enforced in the divorce that can be brought for all the other party wants it. If one party wants to bring it, that's still there. Note also that this court's established, excuse me, the legislature's establishment to no-fault divorce is many years after the passage of the statute. Now there is an option for no-fault divorce. This court has held, and the Colorado courts have held, that recrimination is not a defense for no-fault divorce. But the point that pointed to Susan's right for divorce in Colorado and the nation for that week, I don't believe that the fraud that is serving in the Mexico statute. But to the extent that Colorado would have a similar statute, that's something they could have brought up. They chose to get divorced on the grounds of Canada. That's, I think, an important distinction here. And I do want to just draw on address the point that Justice Sotomayor was making, which is my understanding is that any of the housing council's responses to this court were, well, it might be very hard for me to prove this. We'll go back to trial court, it'll be hard for me to prove this. Maybe I'll lose. But I think that's a very important point because it shows what's happening here. Maybe it can't get these things. Because this case is not capable of proving the merger or driver in fact. Plaintiff can't prove that someone else took his wife's affections. Because that didn't happen.
Mr. Gerstein, let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's assume that my spouse is effectively kidnapped by a cult. Taken into that cult, she's in a cult painted with alcohol. Brainwashing to hate me, to sue me for divorce, and take property that the cult wants. Okay? Are you saying there's no remedy for that?
Yes, you're never saying that because, again,
is that justice?
Of course, I think so, Your Honor, and I think so for two reasons. First, the concept of brainwashing to the extent that this does is incompetent, that's a different question. This mess is actually incompetent.
And
you should take that property and give it to us. Thank you. The concept of brainwashing presupposes that person can't make wrong decisions, which is not the policy of the state. The policy of the state is that a concept like brainwashing, perhaps there's other torches, conduct, threats, or defamation, those are covered by other torts, and that is articulated basically by the O'Neill Court and the Supreme Court of Idaho. That Montana Court versus Florida Supreme Court of Kentucky, that much of the conduct that this court might be concerned about, like that one is covered by other torts. But to the extent that it's not covered by other torts, that's because the person who's alleged to be brainwashed is capable of making wrong decisions. Maybe this court would think they're not good decisions, and that she shouldn't take that property to the vault. But that's her right. And so indeed, our answer is, you know, it's an action in that circumstance. If I'm using the court's indulgence trying to write in that, we did, in fact, seem to have important counts in this case, related to infectious and prima facie court. And I'd like to respectfully suggest that the court consider entering judgment in favor of the defendant and Rebecca Hansen, deciding that only one of those two issues is decided. And the reason why is because, indeed, throughout this argument, opposing counsel has said, as I was mentioning in response to Justice Moore's question, well, you know, we'll get back to the trial court and the jury will sort it all out. And I think, in response to Justice Egan's question about invasive discovery, that is our understanding of the purpose of this proceeding. There's an ongoing proceeding in the Colorado Supreme Court that the parties were attempting to settle. And if the prima facie court survives, which is too far, regardless of the
case. So, rather than expediency, can you explain how prima facie court survived the court?
It can't, in this circumstance, it cannot. This court has been clear in
the circumstances. I guess my direct question is, if we were to loss, how would prima facie court survive?
I think in circumstances like this court's decision shows that I think is the burden of the prima facie court case. In that case, there was an employer who was unduly cruel to an employee that was hired to do this court. That is the case in which this court articulated the concept of prima facie court. I don't think that would be affected by this court's decision. What I mean to say is, for purposes of judgment in this case, those two have to rise and fall together. question. Yes, the jury may choose in all circumstances.
You wanted to send us that I know for the reasons I know.
In the in Washington.
Awesome. So this is that everywhere outside the news. But what was it? Do you see the reasoning in policy for the Republican Party and Chelsea Jones? I don't want to see this issue.
Thank you. I want to thank the parties for their thoughtful briefing in this matter and presenting for all of our argument in a clear and professional manner. The court is going to recess, we're not going to adjourn, so I'll ask the parties remain in the courtroom. Our court will advise and deliberate. We're not able to reach a decision. If we are, we will come back and announce a decision. If we're not, we will release you. The last things that are in the audience can be released by the court. We stay close because if we come back in, we're going to find a good balance for those. So for now, court is released. Thank you. Back on the record, I just want SC40623 certification request from the Rensco Board of Appeals in matter of Butterworth versus Jackson, as is custom the court in these proceedings. We recess to discuss the case and deliberate if we're able to reach a decision. Supplemental briefing by both parties and their release and this matter, the district court granted a motion to review and confirm the motion for judgment on the pleadings, going for summary judgment, and denied the same, certifying to the court of appeals a question of law. Exercise application for interlocutory appeal, writing questions of law, and choice of law question. The court of appeals subsequently certified to this court the question, in essence, whether or not the court as described should be abolished. In this matter, the court, having met the briefings and the other laws of eyes, will reverse the district court and led to the trial court with instructions to dismiss this matter. In considering whether to overrule precedent, this court determines whether the will of the following demonstrate a past decision is incorrect. This is in according to Chavez, 2021, NIC 017, paragraph 52. Whether the precedent is so unworkable as to be intolerable. Two, whether the parties justifiably relied on the precedent so that reversing it would create a new authority. Three, whether the principles of law are developed to such an extent as to leave the old rule no more than a remnant of abandoned doctrine. And four, whether the gaps have changed in the interval the old rule of reconsideration is also brought the old rule of justification. The court finds that factors described in Chavez have been met. In reverse, all story decisis, including personal and others, is required. The reason is that either marital activity or narration would be the basis for tort liability, and that the public policy of the Mexico Interpol Inquiry, the Department of Loving and Marriage, is no longer well founded as it was described in Birchfield. The matter of the statute will be addressed based on the decision by the legislature and the evolution of no-fault divorce on grounds of incompatibility. The unofficial report claim in this case, the instruction will be to dismiss, and the application of this rule will be retroactive. I just saw that the court's decision in this matter, all your opinion will be forthcoming in due course. I thank the parties again and counsel for their representation. I thank you all for their attendance and your attention. And the court, this matter is now submitted, and the court is in recess. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here.